KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. New York Times opinion columnist Ross Douthat has recently covered the college admission bribery scandal and the sexual abuse crisis in the Roman Catholic Church. Douthat is also co-host of the New York Times podcast, The Argument. And today's episode asks whether President Trump incites white terrorism.
All of these things would be happening with or without Donald Trump. I think the dreams of the white ethnostate are responses to much broader dislocations, anxieties, transformations.
A Catholic and a conservative, Douthat will join us to talk about those stories and the latest political news, and that's all next after this. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. New York Times opinion writer Ross Douthat's recent columns have covered topics ranging from the college admissions bribery scandal to anti-Semitism to what he calls the Democrats' culture problem. A Catholic and a self-described conservative, Douthat joins us this hour to share his thoughts on the latest political news and the ongoing sexual abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. And we welcome you to the program, Ross Douthat.
Thanks so much for having me.
Pleased to have you, and I've been reading you for years, and I must say, whether I agree with you or not, you always spur thought, and I hope you'll do that during this hour. In fact, I'm confident that you will. Let's begin, though, by mentioning that you have a book out called To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism, and I would say that it's probably easy to admit to the fact that you're somewhat ambivalent about Pope Francis. I think you've said on record that you prefer, and your favorite pope was Benedict. But let me go right to
I'm in a small group.
You're in a small group, admittedly, among Catholics. But I want to know, sort of cut to the chase here where Pope Francis is concerned, because he's under a lot of fire right now, but not necessarily for the reasons that you bring up in your book. Although you do certainly allude to this, there's a rejection by Pope Francis of a resignation of French Cardinal Philippe Barbarin, who's Archbishop of Lyon, despite the fact that he was convicted for covering up sexual abuse by a priest in his diocese. Your thoughts?
I mean, basically what's happened in Catholicism over the last couple of years is that this kind of, I guess, theological civil war within the church, which has grown, I think, more important under Francis. He sort of reopened debates that John Paul II and Benedict had tried to close about issues like communion for the divorced and remarried, and a whole range of sort of culture issues, has had the return of the sex abuse crisis layered on top of it. And I think the challenge for Pope Francis that's sort of exemplified in certain ways in this latest case is that figures within the church who are seen as or understood to be his allies in this liberal versus conservative theological conflict have often tended to sort of be treated more kindly by Rome, right, when they've gotten in trouble over issues of sex abuse. And the biggest example was probably the now former Cardinal Archbishop of Washington, Theodore McCarrick, who had been placed under some kind of sanctions by Benedict XVI, which were possibly lifted or at least ignored by Francis, in part, I think, because McCarrick was seen as a more liberal figure who was a potential ally for Francis. And so I think the challenge for the Pope now, which was basically the same challenge that has faced each of the last few popes, has been to take an approach to the sex abuse crisis that essentially cleans house without regard to whether a figure is seen as being on your side or on the other side in this liberal versus conservative battle. And then, I mean, there are also further complexities here. I think it's important to say in Francis's defense, in the case of Barbarin, that he's not sort of holding his formal duties and he's awaiting appeal, and they're essentially waiting for the final outcome of the judicial process before accepting his resignation. And they have moved, you know, in cases where there's sort of a finality to the process, cardinals have resigned, and Cardinal Pell in Australia, who was convicted of sexual abuse in a trial that a lot of people have doubts about, has ceded all his offices in the Vatican and so on. So there has been movement. But I think there's a general sense – I think there's a general sense in Rome right now that a lot of the concern over sex abuse is this sort of typical American phenomenon or this Anglo-Saxon phenomenon that tends towards – a kind of hysterical overreach. And then Rome under Francis is also suspicious of the American church because it's seen as a bastion of conservatives who are skeptical of the Pope. And I think that's contributing to certain failures of action in Rome.
Well, Cardinal Barbarin has offered to resign. I just wanted to mention
yes.
that. But there's been a lot of criticism of Pope Francis here. Ann Doyle, for example, who co-directs the advocacy group Bishop Accountability, has said that the Pope is acting autocratically. He's disregarding the victims. He's standing by essentially a complicit bishop and, dismissing the testimony of survivors.
Yes. I mean, I think that Francis has – I think he's taken certain steps, like Benedict before him, that represent progress. But progress on this issue is always sort of two steps behind where the scale of the scandal is. So – there's, I think, a clear sense that the church, especially the church in the United States, has gotten much, much better at handling the problem of abusive priests than was the case in the 1960s and 1970s. And if you look at trends in accusations of sex abuse by priests and how quickly they're removed and everything else, there's a clear dramatic improvement even before some steps were taken in the early 2000s, but certainly since those steps were taken, where if you're worried about abuse by priests, the church is a much safer place than it was for children and much safer, I think, than most secular institutions at this point. But the problem now is that the church hasn't come up with mechanisms for dealing with both sort of cover-ups led by bishops, especially bishops who were sort of in power in earlier periods, and also actual abuse by bishops and cardinals, as you know, as was clearly the case with McCarrick and with some, you know, there's a bishop from the Pope's own native Argentina who's accused not of abusing children but of sexual impropriety with adults, and he sort of still occupies some ambiguous position in Rome. And there I think Francis has sort of moved slowly. And again, I think it's all connected to the fact that the church is just divided into these theological factions where there's a fear of, you know, being too hard on bishops or cardinals who are seen as, you know, on your own side. And this is a problem for conservatives as well. Conservative Catholics tend to be quick to defend conservative cardinals, and more liberal Catholics have been too quick to sort of defend or overlook mistakes and sins and crimes by people who are seen as on their side. And the church is sort of stuck with these two overlapping crises that no pope has found a way out of.
Ross Douthat is our guest, and he's a New York Times columnist, and co-host of The Argument, Times New Opinion podcast. And he's also the author of a book called To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. And there's much more I want to talk with you about beyond Catholicism. But I need to ask, you have certainly come out against abortion. Is that a matter of faith with you? And does that include, for example, rape and incest?
I mean, I think the reason that Catholics are pro-life is not – it's not considered a matter of faith in the sense that there are certain things that Catholics are supposed to believe because they're part of divine revelation, right? So, you know, the virgin birth or the immaculate conception or these kind of things, these are sort of matters of faith. The church is against abortion for the same reason that it's against any form of murder, right? Because it thinks that the best scientific and philosophical evidence argues that unborn children have the same humanity as born children, and therefore its argument is, you know, it's obviously informed by religious ideas, but it's not.
Forgive me, Russ, that doesn't necessarily always include capital punishment, does it?
Well, I mean, technically, under Francis, the church has taken an even firmer line. I mean, effectively, the church is now completely against capital punishment. But the church has also always made the distinction: capital punishment is the execution of the guilty, and abortion is the killing of the innocent. And so, it's, I think, completely reasonable for the church to regard abortion as worse than capital punishment even if it opposes both.
Except when capital punishment is not.
As someone in politics, I want to answer. No, I want to answer your original.
When capital punishment is not the punishment of the guilty, but the innocent, as we've found in some DNA tests through the years. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. But I had to.
That's also part of why the church increasingly opposes it. But those are sort of reasons of implementation, not reasons of whether it's wrong in principle. But just to answer your original question, I mean, I think there's a distinction between, you know, what the church teaches and what you can see as a reasonable political compromise, right? I mean, if you told me that tomorrow, you know, you could make abortion broadly illegal in the U.S. but have exceptions for rape and incest, I would take that deal in a heartbeat while continuing to regard, you know, all abortions as a form of unjust killing. So I think the church's teaching doesn't prevent the idea of sort of compromises that move the country in a more pro-life direction. And personally, I would be happy to support that kind of compromise.
Again, we're talking with Ross Douthat. Let me move on to something that has created a bit of a firestorm recently. And it ties in, I think, to some degree with your conservatism. And it's been labeled reactionary, even labeled racist. And that is what you've said about George H.W. Bush being the old guard and the WASPs, that we have lost something when we lost him, not only in terms of human being who contributed to this country and was president of the United States, but who represented that, I suppose, ruling class, old guard that you see the successors as, well, in some ways inferior to in terms of their gravitas and the kind of ways we should venerate people in power?
Yeah, this was one of my more controversial columns, sort of to my surprise, where I argued that sort of Bush, George H.W. Bush nostalgia was also nostalgia for WASPs, the sort of old line white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Northeastern elite. And a lot of people read that as this sort of defense of white supremacy, basically, which it was not intended to be. I think it's a very good thing that the American elite has become more multiracial, and I mean, I'm a Catholic, so more multi-religious. The white Anglo-Saxon Protestants obviously weren't always fond of Roman Catholics. But I think that the argument that I was trying to make was that there are virtues in having an elite that thinks of itself as an elite that carries a kind of inheritance, right? And one of the problems with what we call meritocracy, which is basically the system of elite formation we have now, is that it tells people who are educated at elite schools and go on to positions of great power that they've earned everything that they have and that it's all, you know, they're there because they're just the most talented and they're just the best, sort of selected through this highly scientific system of testing and admissions and so on. And in practice, that's obviously not true, right? If you look at sort of meritocracy in action, it creates its own kind of upper class in which you have its own kind of children of privilege. And, you know, Ivy League schools today are deeply economically stratified. They draw heavily from the same kind of elite schools that they always have. And in that sense, I think we've lost something when we've lost this sense of sort of, you know, elite responsibility, basically, in a sense that, you know, being an elite can be something that you are in part born to and educated to, and with it comes ideas about sort of service and noblesse oblige that at his best, and to be clear, George H.W. Bush had, like all political figures, plenty of vices, but at his best he embodied them, right? The idea that, you know, children of rich families would go into the military and serve their country overseas and so on. I mean, those are sort of ideas that are more characteristic of the old ruling class than the new one. And I think that, yeah, I think that meritocracy has a lot of vices that are on display in Washington, D.C. and Silicon Valley alike these days.
Yeah, in fact, since we're, of course, part of Silicon Valley here in the Bay Area, I was surprised when you linked you made a connection between Sheryl Sandberg and the young woman from Theranos, Elizabeth Holmes. Could you flesh that out a little bit for me?
Well, I think I was, it's always, you have to think back to what you were thinking when you wrote something months ago. But I think the point I was trying to make was that diversity alone doesn't prevent sort of elite vices from manifesting themselves, right? So both, and this was in a period when Sandberg was taking a lot of fire for her sort of her stonewalling and sort of various defenses of Facebook during the election and afterward that people thought weren't warranted. But I think generally, you know, you can have an elite that is less sexist and more open to female advancement, and that's a good thing. But you shouldn't expect that to fix an elite's cultural vices. And in fact, you know, I just actually watched the HBO documentary on Holmes last night, and it's obvious that sort of both the general vices of meritocracy and sort of the specific let's move fast and break things and fake it till we make it vices of Silicon Valley were totally distilled in her personality and her sort of elite networking skills and all of these things. And the fact that she was a woman doesn't prevent that from happening. So it's not just a problem of, you know, oh, if we just had fewer white tech bros, meritocracy would work better. The culture of meritocracy affects women, it affects African Americans, it affects everyone who rises within it. And if there are vices, they're displayed regardless of race or sex, I think, in the elite that we end up with.
Well, you also say that WASPs, and that whole word WASP, I think you've codified it to a great degree, which is important to do because there are upper WASPs, and then the Kennedys were sort of WASPs. You say that, you know, a lot of people like Roman Catholics or Jews sort of find a way into becoming what the WASPs sort of established and what you were being nostalgic about. The Roosevelts were Dutch and the Rockefellers were German. And so you get into what is a WASP really. But I was struck by a number of other things just in this whole controversy that erupted over this. That is, you say those WASPs, meaning George H.W. Bush and what I guess we would call the ruling class, the aristocrats of America, knew what they were and who they were, and their successors don't. You're disappointed in the successive generation, the replacement generation.
Yeah, I mean, I think the replacement generation has an illusion of earned power and no clear sense of sort of stewardship and inheritance. And, you know, at the same time, it's less snobbish and less bigoted and has various virtues that the WASPs didn't have. And it's not as if, you know, the WASP elite's virtues prevented America from making terrible mistakes and doing terrible things in its past. You know, there's no sort of perfect elite. But I think when you're thinking about your own era, it's reasonable to look at previous eras and say, okay, we're obviously not about to go back to that. You know, the Bushes aren't about to, you know, come out of seclusion and take power again, as Jeb Bush's failed presidential campaign amply demonstrates. But precisely because of that, you want to look at what, you know, whether there were virtues that prior elite had and whether they've been lost. And, you know, I mean, the other thing about the WASPs is that they were a national elite in the sense that they had disproportionate power in certain areas. Like they basically ran U.S. foreign policy for a long time. But America in its past traditionally also had really strong regional elites, you know, who were different from the sort of Yankee blue bloods of the Northeast. The Midwest had its own elite. The South had its own elite. The Mountain West had its own elite. And these elites sort of competed with one another and intermarried and also fought and so on. And I think one of the distinctive things about our own era is that we've sort of lost regional elites and we've replaced them with this sort of fully national elite, where if you go to, you know, the sort of elite college-dominated neighborhoods of New York or Chicago or San Francisco, for that matter, you know, the industries are a little different and there's obviously some differences between Silicon Valley or Silicon Alley on the East Coast. But these are people who are all educated in the same sort of national schools and have imbibed the same sort of national elite or even global elite culture. And I think it's actually contributed markedly to American polarization, where you have this sort of division between sort of elites and populists, between sort of the coastal power centers and the neglected feeling heartland and so on. And again, it's not clear to me how you go back to the earlier system. But at the very least, it's clear that we could learn something, I think, from the earlier system. And, you know, Harvard was less, I mean, the irony of this whole thing is that Harvard, my own beloved alma mater, was actually less powerful nationally in the days of the WASPs than it is in the days of the meritocracy. By sort of reinventing itself as this sort of the ultimate meritocratic school, it's become much more influential than it was in, say, late 19th century America. And I'm not sure that's a good thing.
Well, I want to ask you about the possibility of going back, especially for the concern that many people have about what Trump has wrought upon us. But I want to ask you about widespread criticism that you got, saying, and I'm quoting you here, "I miss the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant leaders." Is that a racist thing to say?
Sorry, I was just drinking some water.
I heard you swallowing. Yeah, it's like Marco Rubio. I'm talking.
Marco Rubio. Yeah, that's right. Another non-WASP. I think it's misunderstood. If you say you miss white rule, then obviously that's a racist thing to say. But again, as you yourself said earlier, the thing about that elite was that it proved itself quite permeable to different families, initially different European families, Dutch and German and so forth. By the middle of the 20th century, it was increasingly permeable to Catholics and even modestly permeable to African Americans. And I think you could imagine a different world where, in effect, Catholics, Jews, African Americans, and ultimately women became part of an elite that still had more of a sense of sort of itself as an elite and a sense of noblesse oblige than the elite we've ended up with. So again, I think it's a good thing to have a multiracial elite. And I think that the bigotry and racism and anti-Catholic bigotry included of the WASPs was a bad thing that we're better off without. But I don't think it's a defense of racism to say this particular elite had certain virtues that our elite has lost.
We're coming up on a break, and I want to invite listeners to join this conversation. We're talking again with Ross Douthat, and lots of topics to cover with him. He covers many topics and ranges about, to put it mildly. If you'd like to join us, though, I want to invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can be part of the program. Call in now at 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And, of course, you can also go to our Facebook page. We do want to hear from you, our listeners. You call Donald Trump, the president, the rich kid with a Wharton degree, posturing as a self-made man and summoning, or at least in many ways galvanizing, populism. And I'm wondering, and I think this goes back to kind of a motif that we've been talking about throughout this conversation. Thomas Wolfe said many years ago he can't go home again. Can we go backward, not only to what you're calling the better, maybe, and being nostalgic about days under George H.W. Bush and the kind of figure that he cut? Or for that matter, can we even entertain the idea of going back where the media is concerned and the coverage of someone like Trump and the way he is pretty much faced off against the media, called it the enemy of the people?
Well, with the media, I mean, I think one thing that's interesting about the media era is that, in a sense, we have gone back, right? That what people – the old media, what we think of as sort of the old media landscape, was actually this very distinctive thing that only existed from, let's say, 1940 till 1980. And it was created by a particular set of social and economic forces that made it possible to have a small set of broadcast networks and these big successful newspapers in one city. And I hear the music coming. So all I'll say is this is our more partisan, crazy landscape looks a bit more like the 19th century and even 18th century American media landscape. And in that sense, it's sort of a weird return to a pre-1950s media past, for better or worse.
My compliments for responding to the music, because it doesn't stop for anybody, least of all us. So let me give out the number again. You can join us at 866-733-6786 if you have questions or comments for our guest, Ross Douthat. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with New York Times columnist Ross Douthat, and he has a new book out, and it's called To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. And certainly there's a lot in that book that I think listeners, particularly of the Catholic faith or who are interested in where the Catholic faith is headed, will want to engage in conversation. We've already talked about the binary maybe between Pope Francis, who many see as liberal and enlightened, and, well, the former Pope, Cardinal Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, who many think of as conservative, and certainly Ross Douthat is a conservative and a Catholic, and he is very sharp and very strong in his opinions. And he's talking also about the old rear guard, as many think of them, of the Bush administration, that is, the first Bush administration. Do you see a decline, and do you see a decline from the values and from the self-restraint and the kind of things that they not only assumed, but in many ways stood for in many people's minds. Those are two big questions, and you may want to weigh in on them, and we do want to hear from you. I want to bring up one other thing before I go to our callers, and this becomes interactive, Ross, and that is politics. There's columns where you have talked about Trump and Jimmy Carter together as both being disjunctive, both being outsiders who built coalitions and who accomplished little, if anything, perhaps from your perspective. But you also make a connection which many people would not make between Ronald Reagan and Bernie Sanders. Talk about that.
Well, so basically the idea of a disjunctive president is that you sometimes get presidents who come in at a time when their political coalition is sort of on its way out and a new political majority is waiting to be formed. And so in Carter's case, he was the last Democratic president of the old New Deal Great Society coalition. And he was trying, I think, in various ways to sort of adapt his party to the era that was coming that ended up being the era of Ronald Reagan and conservatism. But his attempt at adaptation was ultimately a failure. And then Reagan swept in and created the what people have thought of as the conservative era that lasted for decades afterward. And so you could tell, you know, this is slightly silly. It probably won't end up like this. But it's also sort of interesting to see a figure like Bernie Sanders as this kind of parallel to Reagan, this figure who is seen by many people as too old or too extreme to be president, as Ronald Reagan was, but who represent sort of where – there's no question that Sanders represents where the energy is in the Democratic coalition right now. Young people, younger voters especially, tend to strongly support Sanders relative to the other options, while older Democrats aren't so sure. Similarly, Reagan represented sort of where the sort of rising generation of conservatives were in the late 1970s. And, you know, and you can sort of extend the parallel and say, well, just like Reagan ran against Gerald Ford and lost in 1976, Sanders ran against Hillary Clinton and lost in 2016, and now he's coming back for another try. So, you know, obviously history doesn't repeat itself that neatly, but I certainly think you could tell a story where if Trump is this president who's sort of reaching and trying to create a new populist conservatism, sort of, you know, a conservatism for the age after Ronald Reagan, if he fails, then there is room for someone to basically say, create the new Democratic coalition. And Sanders is, in his sort of ideological trajectory, the closest figure to Reagan, who did end up creating a pretty lasting conservative realignment.
Well, we do sort of vacillate between conservative presidents and more progressive presidents. And as you point out, Bernie Sanders has a pedigree ideologically like Ronald Reagan did. But let me go to our callers.
We vacillate.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say we vacillate, but there is a sense in which like Reagan set the tone even for some of the Democratic presidents who followed him, right? Like Bill Clinton was clearly in the shadow of Reagan, just as, you know, Dwight Eisenhower was a Republican president operating within the framework created by Franklin Roosevelt. And I think what's true right now is that we don't have a framework. There's no sort of clearly dominant coalition in American politics. Trump's coalition is a minority coalition. So I think the ambitions of the left right now are to create that kind of coalition that will shape even the Republicans who come after them.
I've got a lot of callers, and I want to go to as many as I can. You did say, though, that you think the Democratic primary is going to be a fight shaping up between Bernie Sanders' redistributive power type peoples against systemic economic overhauls that we see with someone like Elizabeth Warren?
Maybe. I think it's actually more likely to be a kind of a battle between some kind of Sanders-like figure and, whether it's Joe Biden or Beto O'Rourke or somebody else, a candidate who becomes the candidate who says, look, we don't want to make radical change. We just want to get rid of Trump. I think that's the most likely division between people who see the Trump era as this chance for Democrats to radically overhaul the government, the country, and people who say, no, the most important thing is just beating Trump, and we need to run to the middle in order to do that.
Let me get the callers aboard here. Allison, you're first up. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So I have first a comment and then a question. So the first comment I have is that I do agree that saying nostalgia for WASP ruling elites does kind of come across as racist. And I feel like, but I understand where you're coming from, but I feel like you can frame it in a better way. And I feel like you can frame it as among the meritocracy which we find ourselves in now, there is like an inherent lack and a lack of equality because it that meritocracy is formed out of a society based on privilege. So if you get to go to Harvard or whatever, you're probably a privileged person, and in turn, those people see themselves as earning something instead of like in the WASP culture, them owing something back to society. So I feel like you could frame it maybe that way, and correct me if you don't think I'm understanding correctly. And then my question is, as a disenfranchised young Catholic, ex-Catholic, who doesn't see myself ever going back to the Catholic Church because of all the sexual abuse going on, like, what is the future for people like me who are like, people who are maybe millennials who are raised Catholic but can't swallow any of the stuff that's going on with the sexual abuse?
Yeah, thank you for those questions, the comment and the question, Allison. Rostoth?
I mean, I think I generally agree with the first way of maybe helpfully rephrasing my argument. The only thing I would say is that one thing that people need to keep in mind is that meritocracy and equality are actually somewhat opposed, right? That even if you got rid of all economic, socioeconomic privilege and that just had, you know, a sort of whatever a pure meritocracy would look like, it would itself end up creating new inequalities, because the whole idea of meritocracy is that people who are particularly intelligent or particularly talented or particularly hardworking get to attain power and influence and rule. And that is itself a form of inequality. And I think it's actually not surprising that as American society has become more officially meritocratic, it's also become more unequal. The SAT is not a great equalizer. It's not a sort of means to greater economic solidarity. It's a means of plucking talented people from all over the country and giving them sort of extra privileges, right? And maybe that's a good way to order things, but it's not egalitarian. I think there's an assumption Americans have that, you know, meritocracy is good and equality is good and they go together, but I don't think they necessarily do. So that's the first point. The second point isn't just an incredibly hard question. And, you know, I don't think it's necessarily my place to give spiritual advice to anyone sort of, you know, because I don't know where you are in your own, you know, thinking about God and the universe and everything. The only thing I would say about the scandals in the church and how they should affect faith is that, you know, if you look at the history, not only of Catholic Christianity, but if you think of Catholic Christianity as Catholics should, as something that's in continuity with Jewish history before that, with the history of Israel and the Jewish people as set down in the Old Testament, you know, it's a story of constant scandal, constant failure. Right, the claim of Catholicism is, in that sense, kind of like the claim that the authors of the Old Testament make, where they say, "Hey, we're God's chosen people, and you can tell because all our kings are terrible, and we're constantly going after worshiping idols and falling into sin, and we're constantly having to have prophets come and pull us back, and so on." And so, the only appeal that I would make to fallen away Catholics is that, you know, the entire story, not only of your faith, but the whole Judeo-Christian tradition is it's a story of falling into scandal and hoping that God and grace pull you out of it. So I wouldn't turn your back completely on the church just because it's in a time of scandal and crisis, because that just seems to be the historical condition of the whole story of whatever God's intervention in history through Judaism and Christianity is. This is particularly hard, but it's not new.
Let me thank Allison.
It goes all the way back to King David, you know, I mean,
Bathsheba.
King David, right? It's the guy who sends his wife's, his you know, his would-be lover's husband into battle to get him killed. And anyway, that's just my mild religious appeal, I guess.
Let me thank Allison for the call. We're going to get another caller on. Salvador joins us. Salvador, you're on.
Yeah. Hey. Hi, Ross. I just wanted to say thank you so much for helping model civil conversation. I really appreciate the argument in general. The one question I did have is, I'm curious, since it's the New York Times that you're doing that through, are you reaching a broader audience, especially those that lean more to the right. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the question. Ross?
I mean, I think, honestly, it's on the one hand, it's a great gift to be a conservative and a Catholic who writes for The New York Times, which I think it's fair to say, while our audience is vast and contains multitudes, it probably tends to skew away from my politics and religious beliefs a little bit. But I think there's, you know, the point of writing is to argue and convince and maybe occasionally change a mind or two. And I think writing for people who disagree with me is a great thing, and I'm very happy about it. I will admit, though, that, you know, I do wish sometimes that, let's say, Sean Hannity and I could exchange audiences for 6 months. And, you know, that I could write for his audience while he writes for mine, which that, I mean, the Hannity at the Times experiment would be its own entertaining thing, I suppose. But I think, you know, I'll often encounter conservatives who will say, oh, I would read you, but I don't read The New York Times and so on. And I think that, you know, that's the gift of getting to write for people who disagree with you does come with the downside of not always reaching and influencing people who agree with you or might agree with you more if they read you more. So it's a really good question. And I appreciate the compliment, Salvador.
You've also written a lot about the college cheating scandal, and I've got a comment from a listener here I'd like you to address. Justin writes, I have not heard actual numbers of cheaters or a percentage concerning the admissions cheating scandal. To think that a whole system is wrong if a few cheat is not correct. The cheating needs to be confronted. It does not make the merit system wrong.
Oh, no, I think that's totally correct. I mean, I think in a weird way, the cheating scandal, it doesn't vindicate meritocracy, but it shows that the system does work in a sense, in the sense that the people who are cheating, who are trying to get into these schools, had to literally fake SAT and ACT scores in order to get there, right? So it's not that you can simply buy admission, although obviously, you know, large donations to elite schools don't hurt. But in this case, it was that you had to fake intellectual gifts or qualities that you don't actually have in order to get in, which demonstrates that there is, to some extent at least, a real bar that even the children of rich people have to clear, and in this case had to pretend to clear. So I think that point is correct, that the cheating alone doesn't discredit meritocracy. I do think, though, that it points to some of the ways in which, as I said, I think in response to Allison, you know, meritocracy is not perfectly compatible with democracy, right? It's a different kind of system, and it's a system that tends to recreate privilege even when it's working as well as it's supposed to work, right? So, I mean, even like if you take, you know, if you think of elite schools as in part places where, you know, people with high SAT scores meet and get married to other people with high SAT scores, right? Then there's no escape from the way in which it tends to recreate forms of privilege, even when all the people being accepted to those schools deserve, on, you know, based on their brains or SAT scores, to be there.
Would it be fair to say that aristocracy in many ways goes against meritocracy? I mean, when you have the George H.W. Bush kind of aristocracy, it allows for the scions and those who are the descendants to use their connections and use their wealth and so forth and privilege. Whereas now, I'm thinking about Edgar Friedenberg. I don't know if you ever read him, but he was a sociologist who said America has in some ways more an aristocracy of fame than it does of wealth. Now you have these movie star type people who have a great deal of wealth, but they also have fame, trying to manipulate the system.
Well, it's an interesting, I think the fact that in this case you had these TV stars trying to get their kids in shows that, you know, that there are different forms of power and influence and legitimacy, right? And the movie stars have money and fame, but what they want to buy is the legitimacy that comes with meritocracy, with getting your kids into an elite school, right? So it's not enough to be a Hollywood celebrity and be able to say, all right, my kids are going to be fine because we've got money and they can be Instagram celebrities. You also want to be able to slap that USC sticker on the back of your fancy car. So I think you could make a case that the scandal shows that sort of in the end, even the people with, you know, even the people with fame and money want the legitimacy that the meritocracy can offer to their kids, right? I mean, I think it's useful to think of this as there are a lot of different ways you can legitimize a ruling class, right? A lot of different – you can say, you know, the ruling class is legitimate because they're the smartest. Or you could say the ruling class is legitimate because they represent America, right? This is the case for, in part, affirmative action, right? You want a diverse ruling class that looks like the country that it rules. Or you could say a ruling class is legitimate because they have this sense of inherited obligation. And I think you ultimately you want to have all of those things mixed together. And I think there's an argument that the problem with our system is that it skews too much towards the idea that they're legitimate because they have talent, and that there's actually a case that both legacy admissions and affirmative action at elite schools, which tend to be opposed by very different groups of people, right? Conservatives oppose affirmative action and liberals or the left oppose legacy admissions, that both those things are actually kind of good. And it would be bad if colleges got rid of both of them and just had a pure whoever gets the highest SAT score gets in system.
Well, we saw what happened at your alma mater with Chinese students. Let me get another caller on here. And that's Paul. Paul, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, Ross.
Hey, Paul.
I had kind of two questions. The first one was, I understand the meritocracy and the conversations of the wealth and their abuses and their power and stuff like that. But I think the one thing that's being left out of the conversation is that these people of wealth, how they view the importance of an education, and that conversation isn't getting passed on through the news media and all this stuff, that these wealthy people are willing to spend multi-millions of dollars just to make sure that their kid gets an education, and people that are not as privileged aren't hearing those conversations, that the importance of a college education is so vast, so extreme. Do you have an idea why that conversation isn't being put out there? And the second one was, in reference to religion, when you have someone normal, average society that is deemed kind of like a pedophile, they are blasted as a monster, they're pedophiles, they're monsters, and all these other things. Do you have an idea why in the news and other media that these religious pastors that have preyed upon these little children are not deemed monsters and pedophiles?
Two interesting questions. Thank you for those, Paul. We'll go to Ross Douthat.
I mean, maybe we're reading different media, but to your last question, I think the general sense of sort of societal revulsion at pedophile priests is immense, and it explains why the scandal has been such a, you know, such a blow. Totally understandable blow to the credibility of the Catholic Church. I think there's been a change here that affects not only Catholicism but just about every institution of society where the sexual abuse of children is taken more seriously as a grave crime today than it was 40 or 50 years ago. And you see this, you know, not only in Catholicism but in scandals that have come out about, like, you know, private schools. You know, some of New York's private schools have had big, you know, sort of abuse scandals dating back to the 1970s and so on. So I think there's been a shift towards greater moralism around sexual abuse of children, which I think is a good thing. But I think, you know, a lot of the stuff in Catholicism right now deals with how we should think about not the abusive priests themselves, but bishops who either covered it up or just didn't do a good enough job dealing with it. And maybe that's where there's less outrage than there should be, or maybe, as I've suggested, the outrage gets filtered through whether you think a given bishop or cardinal or even pope is on the right side of the Catholic culture war, right? So Pope Francis maybe gets a break from journalists who like him because they think he's a liberalizer, and Pope Benedict sometimes got a bum rap, or maybe in the conservative Catholic press it's the other way around. But I think the abusers themselves inspire the appropriate amount of revulsion in the media. To the first question, I mean, I think there's a lot going on. I think that – I don't think the people trying to buy their kids these slots at elite schools were really thinking of it as buying – education in the truest sense. I don't think they were like, I've got to buy my kid into Harvard so that they can read Aristotle, you know, or become amazing chemists or something. I think there's an understanding that you're buying a certain kind of prestige and a web of social connections when you go to one of these schools. And I think that's borne out, frankly, by the kind of education that these schools give, which can be really good. You can get a really good education at Harvard, but you have to go out and get it yourself. And the schools themselves are much more of a sort of assembly line pushing people out into elite professions and making sure that nobody ever fails out, right? The joke is that once you get into an Ivy League school, it's very hard to get out. I think further down in our society, this is debatable, but I think what you see in working class America is this sense that, one, college is really important, but two, that it's something that's out of reach or too unaffordable, that it's not that sort of working class America doesn't value education, but that there's this sense that is often accurate that it's like, well, you have to take out all these loans and you have to, you know, apply and do all these things that are just sort of the preserve of the upper middle class, and that in many ways what America needs are more institutions, more community colleges, more vocational schools that sort of bridge the gap between the less educated part of the population and the kind of elite reaches of academia. That's sort of what we're missing, is forms of higher education that seem reachable and plausible for people, you know, who aren't about to apply to Harvard. So those are both answers.
Our guest again is Ross Douthat, and his new book is called To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. He's also co-host of The Argument, the Times New Opinion podcast. And here's a tweet from a listener who says, what is the guest's take on the dog whistling that has been a key to strategy to Republican politics, fomenting and abetting white nationalism? And since I mentioned your podcast and gave it a plug here, I have to come back to the fact that there was a podcast, I think, earlier today where you were saying you didn't think, for example, that President Trump had much to do with inciting white terrorism, but he called himself a nationalist. And even in New Zealand, he was cited in the manifesto by the recent murder of all those people in Christchurch. So when you say he doesn't incite, what do you mean exactly?
Oh, I don't know if – well, I shouldn't say I'm sure of what I said, but I think the point I was trying to make was that I don't think Trump himself is the main driver of any of the forms of white nationalism. I think he has probably been behaved in inciting ways and inappropriate ways, and I think he is sort of indifferent to white nationalism and doesn't like to criticize anyone he sees as his own supporter, which is how you get things like his ridiculous behavior after Charlottesville. So I think Trump's approach to race is bad. But I think that things like both the horror in New Zealand and this sort of general, especially internet-based interest in white nationalism are driven by forces much more powerful and important than whatever Trump is tweeting about. I think it's a reaction to broad demographic changes, broad religious changes, the decline of institutional Christianity in the West, you know, things like the sort of catalysts like the Syrian refugee crisis in Europe, anxiety over falling birth rates. There's just a lot going on, and there's a reason that you have sort of populist and nationalist parties springing up all over the developed world. Trump. Even a world without Trump, these trends would all still be there. And the most extreme of these figures, the guys who actually commit acts of violence, tend, you know, to be sort of dismissive of figures like Trump in the end and say, oh, you know, well, Trump, he has some good ideas, but he doesn't understand what the white race really needs or something like that. So I just think there's a tendency for all our political discussions in this moment to center around Trump, and it's worth sort of stepping back and looking at the larger cultural matrix in which this is happening. But Trump has definitely, I mean, to take the caller's original point, I think in the Republican Party over the last 30 or 40 years, there was a sort of steady decline in racialized appeals and dog whistle rhetoric. And then Trump has sort of re-escalated those kind of appeals. And I think that's a bad thing.
Though Trump is, and you're right, we talk too much about Trump, but though Trump is of, I believe, German and Scotch descent, would you say he's part of that old order that you refer to as the white wasp working class?
No, Trump, and this was also one of the things that I could have better explained in my original controversial column, but no, Trump is, he is technically a white Anglo-Saxon, or in his case, white Germanic Protestant. But he's not a WASP in the sense that George H.W. Bush was a WASP at all. And in fact, his entire public persona from the beginning in the 1980s was built on this sense of sort of outer borough New York rejection by the old money elite of New York. So everything about Trump, I mean, Trump is, you know, he's a totally post-Protestant figure. He comes out of his pastor as a kid was Norman Vincent Peale, who was sort of the original Joel Osteen, basically, the sort of power of positive thinking Christianity. And Trump has jettisoned the Christianity and kept some of the power of positive thinking, God wants you to be rich stuff. But no, his whole affect is post-WASP in a defiant and intentional way.
Since you mentioned theology, we got seconds left here, but Michael makes a remark I'd like a quick response to you from. He says, I believe, Mr. Douthat's thoughtful criticisms of Trump lack the moral strength and clarity that these times demand. Mr. Douthat possesses virtues that might enable him to inspire or even play a role similar to a much-needed Dietrich Bonhoeffer figure vis-a-vis Trump. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, by the way, was a German pastor and theologian and very vocal in his anti-Nazi dissent.
Well, listen, you know, I mean, we'll have a better sense in 10 or 15 years. But I would say that I wrote very, very intense anti-Trump columns in the run-up to his election. But since his election, my perception of Trump is that he's much weaker than a lot of his strongest critics think and is therefore, I don't see him, and I make no apologies for this, as a kind of Hitlerian threat, an incipient tyrant. I think he's a weak president who's an authoritarian in his Twitter feed. And at the moment, my commentary reflects that.
Unfortunately, you hear the
music
again.
We'll see how
again.
It looks.
Thank you, Ross.
I hear the music, and we'll see how it looks in the future.
Appreciate your being with us. Thank you so much. Ross Douthat.
Thank you for having me.
To Change the Church is his new book. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.